ओमज्ञान्तिमिरन्धस्य ज्ञानञ्जनशलाखय चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः श्रीचैतन्यमनोभीष्टं स्थापितं येन भूतले स्वयं रूप कदा मह्यं ददाति स्वपदान्तिकं वन्देऽहं श्रीगुरुन् श्रीयुतपदकमलं श्रीगुरून् वैष्णवंश्च श्रीरूपं साग्रजातां सहगना रघुनाथान्वितं तां सजीवं साद्वैतं सावधूतं परिजनासहितं कृष्णचैतन्यदेवं श्रीराधा कृष्णपदां सहगना ललिता श्रीविशाखान्वितांश्च हे कृष्णा करुणा सिन्धु दीनबन्धु जगत्पते गोपेश गोपिका कान्त राधाकान्त नमोऽस्तु ते तप्तकाञ्चन गौराङ्गी राधे वृन्दावनेश्वरी वृषभानुसुते देवी प्रणमामि हरिप्रिये वाञ्छकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुव एव च पतितानां पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः जय श्रीकृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर श्रीवासादि गौर भक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे 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 कृष्ण सो व्हेन आई फर्स्ट केम इन कॉन्टैक्ट विथ इस्कॉन यू नो स्टार्टेड हियरिंग द फिलोसॉफी ऑफ कृष्ण कॉन्शियसनेस सो many things were different no you all also must have noticed sometimes we don't notice but later we realize that so many things our language we speak the words like sense gratification never heard before until I came to the movement obeisances so likewise I remember that when I heard you know that being your servant and all letters also devotees would write thinking I'm your servant So, it took some time to really understand. Well, I don't know if well, really understood now, but at least to mentally understand, you know, that why we talk about being a servant. Because our concept is that, you know, being a servant is a low in hierarchy, you know, in our life. And if somebody was to, in my office, if people ask me, So what do you do in the temple? If I say I want to strive to be a servant, you know, they think I'm psychologically, there's some disorder. So I used to think that way that there would be some, so it was a little embarrassing to hear that. Now, but over time you realize, and then actually you really start appreciating when you see others, when you associate in the temple, one of the major purposes of the temple is you associate in many ways. Right now there's association also. When we are really, ultimately we are surrendering to Krishna by so many ways. So when we hear the scriptures, when we see the examples of devotees, when we hear about the history of not just the ISKCON movement, but also the our parampara and Krishna and all his pastimes. And then we see that the greatest of personalities, people who have been emperors of the entire universe, not just you know, one small city or a town or a country, how they live their lives. So then you start realizing that actually what it means to be a servant and what it really means to how to combine that with our regular life. Like for instance, when Krishna spoke to Arjun on the battlefield, so Arjun was completely surrendered. Since he was a soul surrendered to Krishna, Krishna gave him all the knowledge. But then that same servant, became the fiercest warrior the next second. He picked up his Gandiva bow and he discharged his duties, and he was the main, you can say, reason why the Pandavas could be victorious. So then we can understand that it isn't really that you, when you come to the temple, you come in a certain mood, and then it's something external that you have to look humble, feel humble, and then when you go out, you don't look humble. No, humble, humility is internal. So when we, how do we inculcate that? What does it mean to be a servant? What it means to carry that even in, try to carry it even in our day-to-day lives. So first, philosophically, we need to understand that, you know, Rupa Goswami has said it in one of the most famous scriptures that we read, Nectar of Devotion. One of the basic foundations he has said is that there are four preliminary requirements, requisites of a sincere disciple. And the first is that he has to be, you know, surrendered to, take shelter of a spiritual master. By the definition, master means someone who is your superior in all respects, and someone who, whose command you will obey. So, then second is to take initiation from such a spiritual master. And initiation means that you take guidance from the spiritual master in, and carry it for the rest of your life. Through that you learn devotional service. Then obeying the instructions of the spiritual master with faith and determination. And the fourth is trying to follow in the footsteps of the acharyas under the guidance of the spiritual master. So these, he calls these the preliminary requirements. So when we hear the philosophy and we see in action people whom we want to, whom we respect and whom we want to emulate, follow, then actually we can see that we get that strength and the conviction that yes, this is what it is. And by doing it, then we actually find happiness. You know, we then start understanding it. At least we get it in temporary, we may not be, even if we are not, we may be surrendered in some moments, we may be defiant in some moments because we have our conditionings. But you start understanding and then you can see the difference that when I am in, what it means to be, to get a glimpse of the, of some spiritual taste. Jiva Goswami, who was also one of the six Goswamis and the nephew of Rupa Goswami, so he actually calls it that the spiritual master is the Atma of a disciple. That means the life force of a disciple. Why? Because he says that the it's like when you actually come to, when you really take initiation from a spiritual master, which means when you begin your spiritual life, formally in that sense, then you really wake up. So, it's like waking up from a dream. So, we may go around like a zombie, you know, we may discharge our duties without any connection to what is happening elsewhere. We have our own narrow sense of what we need to achieve, and then if we have a good fortune, karma, Krishna has given us intelligence, and we use it, and then we became wealthy, and then we follow that only, and then we think they are successful. If we have some misfortunes and we don't, we fall, we have problems, then we feel we are unfortunate, maybe we start hating the world, we may do other things. So, there is, in either case, we don't have any room for Krishna. But here, when we start the process of spiritual awakening, that's why he calls it the that he is the Atma, because the life begins, real life begins when you are awake. Right? For a baby, you can say now he's, the moment a person dies, you say he's lifeless. Moment, till that moment the person has got life in him, that means got the soul. So the soul is really, in essence, the spiritual knowledge that the spiritual master gives us. And we should also understand that all the Vaishnava acharyas, all the Vaishnava sampradayas, rather, stress the importance of having the position of a spiritual master, all of them. So therefore, the need for guidance becomes very, very important. And we have examples of taking Krishna himself in all his various avatars that he came. When he came as Krishna, Krishna came himself 5,000 years ago, he Sandipani Muni was his spiritual master. He served him. He and Sudama, his very closest friend, they, when they were children, they served him so faithfully, and then they got blessings from their guru. Then Lord Ram also, as we know, he had taken Vishwamitra Muni, and then he was taking guidance from Vasishtha Muni also. So same way Chaitanya Mahaprabhu also took his guru. So Ishwar Puri. So we see that he's emphasizing the need to follow. So right now, we may not have a formal spiritual master, but the idea is that to be a servant, to understand devotional service, we need guidance. And if we are sincere, and then we will have the guidance at all times, because you may have different types of spiritual guides. You may have an initial guide, you may have someone who's your guide, who gives you instructions right through life. And then you may also have, if you're fortunate, we get the formal initiation from a fire sacrifice from a spiritual guide. But the need for instructions on how to perform devotional service, even the word devotional service, I had not heard about that word till, you know, most of us are not. This is a typical, you can say, Vaishnav lingo. It's not a normal language. But what it actually means, it conveys everything. So it's service in devotion. Otherwise, you can say, what is the occupation? I'm in government service. What is the occupation? I'm in banking service. So we use the word service very loosely. What we mean by government service is I get paid by the government. I'm not selflessly doing a free service. I'm not surrendering in that sense. So we may use it, but here, devotional service, service in devotion means it's a matter of consciousness and the heart. So while our occupation may need us to do the services, as we all have to really be occupied, that's the nature of the mind, that it's a matter of purifying the mind, but otherwise there is always going to be activity. So the highest form of service is devotional service, because that is what we see in bhakti, where it gives us a chance to bring all that we have been given. Even if everyone has been given something. We have whatever attributes we have, we can purify it and make it positive. So it's not a matter of, you know, a class hierarchy or a caste hierarchy, standard of, you know, what level we are in society. It has absolutely nothing to do with it. And we have seen this over and over again, like when Srila Prabhupada, whom we have, who has been the founder acharya of ISKCON, and who has been our contact with the parampara. He had a wonderful father, a very great devotee, but we have never gone to the extent of saying that, well, you know, Prabhupada was born in this gotra and this caste and all, didn't matter. Or that, you know, he was, because he did this degree or that degree. He was educated, but it is incidental. It wasn't really the main reason. So we see that we may be educated, we may be literate in the academic sense. I wouldn't say educated, because the real sense of education is different. But the way we see in society, we say what we talk of academically qualified. So if we have, that's nothing wrong in it, but it is not that it gives us a superior level. Neither does this wealth give us a superior level, or any attribute physically that is there. It may be our good fortune to have that. But the consciousness and our character, which is really critical, and that is what needs to be purified, and that is where devotional service comes in. So devotional service, or service and devotion, includes everything. That means if you really want to be a servant, even to do if you are doing 16 rounds, or if you are chanting the holy names, that also is not something, because we are not easily, it doesn't come easily, especially initially. But even otherwise, right through, there may be times when we are occupied with other things, and we may have many reasons to feel that I am not attracted to the holy name. So so even not succumbing to that temptation of giving up even for a day is also a surrender to Krishna. Because without that, we are surrendering to the mind, surrendering to Maya. You know, the mind is tricking us into thinking that I've got this reason, that reason, we rationalize it. So, therefore, devotional service includes everything that we do. Our chanting, our action, our words, our thinking. So, this is where, and to the extent that we are completely linked to that extent we can be purified. But also on the other hand, there are examples like Indra displeased his, like Krishna got blessings from his guru, Lord Ram also, and they achieved a lot. Bali Maharaj also did a lot, and he pleased the spiritual master, he got the powers. But Indra displeased and Brihaspati and he lost everything, at least for some time. So basically, if we now equate that to Srila Prabhupada, because Prabhupada is our immediate link, and also since he brought the spiritual revolution just hardly 50 odd years ago, 51 years actually, 52 years ago, so it is readily accessible to us and comparable to whatever we understand. So it becomes easy to follow. So these principles, if we see, that how did he, what did he do to become a servant? Because he always said that he was taking such great pride that I'm the servant of my Guru Maharaj, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, His Divine Grace, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, and his Guru Maharaj, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, took great pride in saying that he was a disciple and servant of his Guru, Gaur Kishwardas Babaji Maharaj. Right? So, Prabhupada, every action that he did was really only to please the spiritual master. And if you go to see that, Srila Prabhupada, as we know, that he first met his spiritual master first time in 1922, and then he departed from this world in 1977. So that was a span of 55 years. But in the 55 years, it's only the last 12 years when he formed ISKCON and then toured 14 times and made devotees, made temples, and really started what is now gaining so much momentum. So that means the remaining 43 years, do we say that Prabhupada was not successful, or Srila Prabhupada was struggling that time? How do we read those first 43 years? So externally, the last 12 years, there were a lot of the manifestations in, he was blessed by Krishna to have so much success. But first 43 years, that is after meeting a spiritual master, he was exactly the same Krishna consciousness, he was exactly the same surrendered soul that he was for the last 12 years. So there was no distinction. Externally there was activity which really suddenly it was miraculous. But internally he was prepared for whatever was there. When he went on Jaladut, he practically died. He had heart attacks. And if you see his poem that he has written to on the Jaladut also, he is completely, totally surrendered, saying, whatever you want me to do, I will do. That's his mood. He's telling Krishna. And then later on also, when he is getting so much success and millions of people are attracted to hearing what he's saying, taking his books. By now, more than 500 million pieces of literature have been sold in the last so many years, in the last 50 years, which is this is the highest selling Bhagavad Gita in the world. And Bhagavad Gita is, I think, probably the largest selling piece of literature. I think just after the Bible is the second largest ever. So, he was not carried away by that. I mean, he saw it, everything he saw coming from Krishna, but he carried on doing what he had to do. So this is where we learn from him. That devotional service means that irrespective of what happens externally, some days it goes very well, some years may go very well, suddenly we have a debacle, but you carry on. And his activity was such that he was preaching, he was writing his books, he was meeting people, and everything was with a sense of urgency. But he didn't change his tone, mood, approach because of the external situations. For instance, he was extremely protective and defended his disciples, because they were such literally children. I mean, practically, you can imagine that if we have felt, being in India, and we are familiar with the Bhakti movement, we are familiar with at least religion, we are familiar with saffron clothes, we are familiar with temples, we are familiar with deities. I mean, that is almost every Indian would have access and seen it. Just imagine if you are born in a Western country and suddenly you see an elderly person coming and then you start hearing him, and that too, most of the people who came to him were not even in a completely rational sense, because they were under influence of drugs or something. And at that time, you just when you are hearing this such so-called foreign words, the impact is very difficult to imagine what a challenge must be for them to absorb it and to follow. And through that, they had followed it. So Prabhupada had to guide them because they were completely like children, not knowing what to do, simplest of things. But he never hesitated to defend them, but he never hesitated also to chastise them if necessary. And it was not like he was never looking for an image. He was always, whatever the situation needed. There was an incident in Amsterdam 1972 when the devotees had called Prabhupada and said that, you know, we are going to have deities. And so Prabhupada had come there. But obviously they were not ready. There were just a few devotees and they didn't really understand many aspects. But Prabhupada never criticized them or humiliated them. He corrected them when needed. So at that instance, there were the cameras and the people were there with their, you know, TV and so on, all waiting. So one would think that Prabhupada would be much more, you know, he'd be careful what to speak in front of them. He was only concerned that he had to teach his children, his disciples who were like his children. So they were at that time, you know, that they didn't know that they had to bring fruits also. So many paraphernalia you need. So they had got, but he's saying, where are the fruits? They said, Prabhupada, they're in the fruit salad. You know? So they didn't know that they made the fruit salad out of the fruits. So Prabhupada was upset and he expressed his displeasure. So from that, but on the other hand, once his godbrothers were there in Mayapur and fire sacrifice was there, and his godbrothers were very learned people, extremely powerful preachers, and they were very familiar with all the, I mean, they were experts in even the fire sacrifice and so on. So they saw that Prabhupada's disciples were struggling. I mean, they were making mistakes, elementary mistakes in the fire sacrifice steps, you know, some of the things. So they were disapproving and they were telling Prabhupada that, you know, they're making such mistakes. So Prabhupada just took it by saying, no, they're learning. So it's okay. It's nothing big. So, you know, he was always very reassuring, protective, and that gave confidence to the children. He was a great leader. So even leadership principles we can see. But the thing is that they knew that what he spoke came from his heart and was for their well-being. So when he chastised them also, they took it with pride and they learnt it. When he was, most of the time when he was, he was always very loving and compassion, but sometimes it came out as a chastisement and most of the time it was by reassuring words. So they had that confidence that if they made mistakes, it was okay, but they had to learn from it. So he always saw himself as an instrument. So as an instrument, he had to protect his disciples, he had to protect Krishna. Once at Chopati Beach, he had a huge pandal program. There may be 40, 50,000 people he was invited. It was not only his program, there were many other sadhus from other sampradayas, and not just Vaishnava sampradayas, many others were there. And not only, I mean, there were Jain monks and many other religious leaders. So somebody got up and when Prabhupada was speaking, and somebody said that, suddenly started saying, I am God. So Prabhupada was very upset. He says, if you say you are God, you are actually dog. It's not G-O-D, it's D-O-G. In front of everyone, you know, he chastised him. Because he had to defend his beloved Krishna, you know. He said, you cannot let that kind of statement go. Okay, I am. So many, some of the sadhus on the stage actually walked off. And they felt, oh, sadhu means how he can speak like this, how he can chastise. Prabhupada didn't care for that. It was not that he was so compassionate, he would feel for every person. He would feel, he would cry, like when the Food for Life program started, when he was in Mayapur, when he saw that in a distance once when one young boy and a dog were fighting for a piece of chapati. And Prabhupada was, you know, he had tears in his eyes, and he that time said that no person in 10 miles radius of the Mayapur temple should go hungry. And from that day, thousands of people are fed every day, every single day. So, and many temples actually have the thing, including ours. Most of the temples will always have a program which is open for all. So Prabhupada was very compassionate, not only to human beings, even to ants and to other things. He never got disturbed by that. So we know that he had such compassion. But out of his compassion, when something which is which could be of such, it is a blasphemy towards the Lord to say that I am the Lord. You know, that Prabhupada would not sustain. So he would absolutely tell very clearly. So Vaishnava would really say all glories to Guru, all glories to Krishna. But if we are materially motivated, we will be looking at I. So that's where the challenge of being a servant or following devotional service is, that primarily we are looking at what I can do, that I have done. People should know that. We have a strong craving, no? That we have done something, people should know that it is me, you know, who has done it. Somehow we have to get it to someone's notice that I have done this. The mistakes we make, we don't want people to know, but what we have done, that becomes very important for us. And, you know, so this is what is known as the false ego. This is another word which sounds, now we'll talk about it, and because if there's false ego, there's real ego. So what is false and what is real? So, it's critical because false ego is the basis for all our attachments. The false ego is nothing but the misidentification. So there's the misidentification, thinking that the whole world revolves around me. So I, me and mine. And the real ego is when we take pride in, not ourselves, but take pride in Krishna or Krishna's activities, Krishna's devotees, the six Goswamis, the Acharyas, the Parampara, so many people who have done. We really take pride that what they have done. We glorify them, speak about them. So to the extent that we respect the Parampara, to the extent that we try to follow and push our mind towards it, to that extent we will come closer to being humble. Because we cannot, either we glorify by word or by action or by thought, we glorify Krishna and all that is Krishna's pastimes and his devotees' temples and forms and so on, or we'll be glorifying ourselves one way or the other. There is nothing in between. So somebody will be getting ourselves or objects which we would want to be. So we may have some superstars, we may have objects of our worship. So the object of worship could be either right or wrong. So basically it is, it's really why it becomes important, because to the extent that we can glorify, to that extent we see our position as very, very small, and then we actually see, then we see how futile we are. When you say futile, means we have such limitations. We make mistakes. We can't even see behind our head, not even 1 foot behind our head. And we think we want to see Krishna. And we can't even hear what is in the next room. And we have such limitations. Senses are limited. So we understand the magnitude of Krishna's greatness when we see his creation, his how the world works, how the body is created. So many aspects every day we see. So that consciousness of that develops, that is really Krishna consciousness. So to the extent that we associate, to the extent that we glorify, we look at that. But this doesn't mean, see, sometimes what happens that we, when we think like that, then we feel that we think badly of ourselves. And then, so somebody will say that then, that means I should have no confidence in myself, I am a nobody, I am useless, I can't do anything. Yes, we should know that when we come to the sadhus, when we are hearing, we know our real position is that we means everybody, all living entities, whether the President of the United States or the Prime Minister of India or of China or wherever, ultimately we are all marginally more powerful than the other, tiny. But in the whole part, everyone is born, everyone is going to die, everyone is going to grow old. So we are all very, very, very helpless and in relation to Krishna. So that is true. But at the same time, we have been given attributes by Krishna. Krishna has given different backgrounds and attributes to different people. We have different characteristics. So it is not as if we abandon that. Like we took the example of Arjun. So Arjun had tremendous capabilities. He also had training. He became the world's best archer and he used it. So when he needed to. But when he had to talk to Krishna on the battlefield, his position was that I know nothing, I am a fool, and please help me. So when we come to sadhus, when we come to spiritual, elevated, respected people, we take that position that we are not the controllers and that we know nothing. But when we are in our own occupation, we have to carry that mood that we are not the controllers, but on behalf of Krishna and his devotees, if we have been given some responsibilities, then what is the best way I can do? So there's a very nice phrase which you may have read, because it comes on and off in on the internet and so on. It says that don't think less of yourself, think of yourself less. So there's a difference. When you say don't think less of yourself, meaning don't demean yourself, saying I can't do anything, I'm a loser. People think, if my boss thinks I don't have any capability, I don't have any capability. I become very timid, or you just want to give up at the smallest things. You don't want to proactively do anything. So don't think less of yourself, but think of yourself less. That means the thing is that we don't think, when you say don't think of yourself less, means that I should just not think that I am the doer. So that Krishna is the doer. So everywhere we are thinking, what is in it for me? I want new clothes. I want to eat well. I want to look well. I want to be in. My family is there, but my family is supporting me. I am doing this for them. And if my family is happy, I am happy. So it becomes an extended I. Or it may be just the neighborhood. So basically, it's all ultimately the center is I. So think of yourself less, but don't think less of yourself. So that gives us the idea that we, whatever we have been given, you can see in Prabhupada's life, it took some examples, but like he had so many setbacks, but he fought. His whole life is full of setbacks, and not just him. I mean, somehow the greatest of personalities in history have had the greatest of setbacks. But then through that only we have seen how great they have been. So you see through the various yogas also. So this is a lesson we learn, that going through these challenges are actually only to show us that we can, we have to do the best of our capability. And the result is in Krishna's hands. So if you concentrate on the effort and not the result, then Krishna, if he chooses to deliver material success, that is great. If he chooses that we are going to have a failure materially, well, that is also in the opinion of Krishna and the sadhus, it is still great. So we have to develop the question, whose opinion counts for us? And then that should guide our life. So there are people who have had, even in our parampara, if we say, is Prabhupada the greatest because so much has been achieved by him, we can actually tangibly see it, compared to his spiritual master, it would be very offensive to think like that. But people sometimes do question, okay, is that, and what about Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's spiritual master, God Kishwardas Babaji Maharaj? Now, God Kishwardas Babaji Maharaj was just a Babaji, means he was so elevated, but he was so kind of away from society, and that he deliberately chose to stay, in such places where people wouldn't go. Like he would be, because he didn't want any fame, he didn't want people to come after him. But Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's father, Bhakti Vinod Thakur, knew of his greatness. So he, and Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was very elevated. He educated also. Apart from being highly spiritually educated, he was also materially very brilliant. And, at the age of 11, he had mastered all the scriptures, he could give powerful lectures, he could debate, and he had learned Persian, Arabic, so he was very, very educated. And God Kishwardas Babaji Maharaj, by material standards, was not educated. And he didn't want any disciple. And he was always staying, near urinals and all in the jungle, so people would not come to him deliberately, they just avoid. But he still, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said that if you don't give me initiation, I'll have to jump in the river. I mean, he just persuaded him and he begged him. Because he saw that the greatness was not the externals. So therefore, we cannot say that it is a mystery to us, but it is clear to Krishna. How Krishna would want the world to flow, how the Kali Yuga will progress, how things are going to deteriorate, when things will improve. It's all... we have guidelines in the scriptures, but on moment-to-moment basis only he knows. He and his representatives know. So it is all a chain of disciplic succession. Each one has their own role. So it is like a collective effort, but each one has. So, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's, you can imagine how powerful he was if Prabhupada, whom we worship, and he is totally surrendered, and he feels that, he proudly says that my spiritual master defeated me. So that just gives us, one statement tells us what is the greatness of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, to whom Prabhupada was always considering himself fallen. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur considered himself that I will end my life if I don't get initiation from you. So you don't need to physically meet Godkrishna Babaji Maharaj to understand how elevated personalities and how absorbed they were in Krishna. So sometimes we do make a mistake of judging from that. So we don't go by our external judgments. We really need to see from the eyes of the Shastra and also from the words of the sadhus. And the worst part is that, you see, the false ego is so kind of it's so poisonous that and also very addictive, because what happens is that when we want, we get the worst of both ends. For instance, when we start saying I've done this, I've done that, so on the one hand, the Vaishnavas really don't like to hear that. They may be polite and they will not, but they are not concerned about it. You know, you may have achieved whatever. It is really, if you speak like that, it doesn't really go well. And the materialistic people feel envious if you speak that. So actually, there's nobody you are pleasing. So Maya in that way is so cruel that you may have a strong urge, but you don't please anybody. And ultimately, we feel we are happy just by saying it, and we go by the external. Somebody will politely say something. But actually, really speaking, there's unhappiness more than that, because the Vaishnavas are dismayed, because they know that such an attitude is not good for us. But they will not criticize us, but they will be sorry for us. And the materialists will be envious for a thing, or they will certainly be critical and say, well, they will either doubt us, or if it is a fact, that they will certainly, try to pull us down. But then why do we get so addicted to it? One of the reasons our Shastra says, because, as I mentioned, that we, if we don't glorify the Lord or His devotees, then we are going to glorify us. But also, today the environment is such that it is very lucrative, very financially rewarding also, to have our image. So everyone strives for that, because even an ordinary person getting a job, it very much depends on how you look, how you present yourself, how your tie is knotted, how your hair is combed. So all these, if you see in the last 20 years, the personal care department of all divisions of all the of those consumer product companies is the most profitable. The margins are by far the highest, because people will pay any price to, once says you apply this cream and become fair, they will do it. If you apply this, it'll happen. It's a craze that they keep pushing us towards, how we look, how we talk. There are so many classes which kind of. So it may be necessary up to a point. There is. It is not that we have to throw it out of the window. If our job requires it, if you are in hospitality industry, certainly we have to learn it's part of our job. If you do a job well, you have to do it. But if our internal consciousness becomes predicated to that means it becomes the most important thing for us, and then we only look towards that, then in every aspect of life we'll be looking a judgment, our value judgment will be based on that. That's the danger. So if we understand, if we are constantly in contact with the Shastras and with devotees and with the scriptures and the philosophy, then slowly we will be able to discriminate and see that while we may be able to do the needful, and do what is necessary, but we don't get carried away to the extent that we also start judging people according to these external values. So that's where the challenge is. So I was talking about how lucrative it is, because today, just a simple example will give you what it is, but these are facts, that the most successful people, let's say, you take the one or two of the highest paid sportsmen, or one or two of the highest paid in the film industry, if you see the annual salaries, and these are published figures, annual salaries 150 to 200 crores a year. Individuals getting 150 to 200 crores. Why? Because it's not like because they play cricket very well or they are acting well that they get some salary. But most of the money they make is by endorsements. So, for instance, if they're endorsing a fan or endorsing a shoelace or endorsing a tie, endorsing means you represent and say, this is a very good product. Per day, they're paid 2.5, 3 crores per day. So if they're needed for 5 days in a year, morning to evening, they get 10 crores just for endorsing a fan, saying that, but you know, they have to give that commercial 1 minute. But then you have to reach that level. So there are many levels. So even chota mota levels, you know, somebody who's C grade will get 5 lakhs, you know, to cut ribbon because he's noticed, you know, he may not be in the top star. So if somebody's opening a bank branch or somebody's opening a shop, he'll call him and then he just to, because he, that person calls him because he feels that because of that I'll get many people around my environment, neighborhood, you know, to come there. So both they, so this is how the material world works, that I need prosperity, I need to sell more, I need to let people know more, so I get famous people, so I have to pay them. And the famous people get money, so they're happy. So the thing is that because it's so attractive, therefore everybody's attention generally goes towards that, so where can I make the maximum money? So making money is not a crime. The problem is not about making money, but the problem is getting so absorbed only in that, that our education also is geared towards that. So nothing wrong with the education per se, but if it is only focused towards marks and therefore if you get 90% and you can't get admission in a good, you know, if people want to commit suicide or they're so depressed because, and they feel low about themselves because they feel that somebody who got 93 is more clever than I. But that, just because you could reproduce some questions and answer them well, doesn't make you a better human being. But then that alters our personality. It alters our value system. So that's where the danger is. So we may have to go through this system in life. You know, we can't avoid it. But while we are doing it, we can internally strengthen our understanding of this. What is Krishna consciousness? What is God consciousness? Why we need to come closer to God? So that we know that externally I'll do what I need to, but internally I know what I should be striving for, where I will find my happiness, and then there'll be a contentment. There'll be relief that, okay, you have setbacks externally. You lose a job or if something happens, you have a quarrel or you have health problems. You know, you try your best, but you still, this is life. You may make mistakes. But internally, you know that that setback will not completely push you off. You know, you'll still be, in fact, it'll give you greater realizations oftentimes, greater understanding, the experiences. You also somehow then we start understanding why Krishna put us in this position. Because oftentimes we become serious in our spiritual life when we have setbacks. So maybe the setback is because we have we needed to be straightened up a bit, or maybe later on we realize that because it happened so many, it was an event which changed my life. So whatever way, we accept it. So accepting Krishna's supremacy is really the key surrender, the key thing that we need. Because ultimately, what is the meaning of a servant? A servant is who very dutifully follows his master and does what he says. Why the Western world today prefers dogs than human beings as pets? Because the dog is such a faithful person. And you just do what he says. Sit, stand up, do this, do that. So, but then unfortunately, we want to gratify our senses, so we want that dog to give us pleasure. Because we are expecting that from a human being, we don't get it. But really speaking, if we understand that with all our intelligence, dog has no intelligence because a dog is an instinctive animal. Well, we are an animal which has got rationality. So if you understand from a rationality that this is why I'm doing what I'm doing, and especially after hearing that the reality that Krishna always was, is, and will ever always be. There was never a moment he was not there. And we also are part and parcel of him. We are also eternal, but we have a certain external body, certain external duties are there, everything that comes through that. So while we start, and if you go through life understanding that, as we grow and understand that more, our appreciation for Krishna consciousness improves, then life will go on. And there are so many examples in front of us. So many examples just in our congregation, what to speak of other temples and other devotees and other things, that people who take to spiritual life, how they have become, even if they're just in the background, but they have become examples of how they can take reversals in their life. So learning to take reversals is, if you take that, then really you have accomplished the most difficult challenge. Because that is finally, when we talk of bad news, or when we talk of something which is a setback, it is ultimately we're talking of reversals. So if we understand how to accept the reversals, and consistently, then really that gives us not only just peace and contentment, but we carry on what we are doing. It is, what I'm saying is not easy and it doesn't always happen, but at least we know that what I don't know. So as I'm speaking to you, when I say with conviction that yes, this is the way, not that I will accept reversals all the time, but I know that I should be accepting, I'm not able to accept it, something is missing, I need to work on myself. But I know that there's no other way, that Krishna wants me to accept it, I have to accept it. There must be a reason. I must try to what I can. See, it's like if there's a if the setback is through material nature, if there's an earthquake or major drought and something happens and there's a major burglary in the house, something which is uncontrollable, you will do what you can, but there's a lot of it which you can't. Like there's a health setback, a dear one has a terminal disease and something like that. You do, but you can't help it. But when it comes to relationships, when it comes to devotees, or when it comes to other living beings, when they're causing problems, as we see it, this is an age of quarrel and hypocrisy. So when you have problems, at that time we will be oftentimes making mistakes, but then we learn at the end, later on, that, okay, I should be, maybe I spoke this, I shouldn't have done this, I could have done this better. And next time we will do an improved situation compared to if we didn't have this knowledge. So having this understanding is something which is very practical. So, and that's the spiritual life is a science. The Prabhupada said it's a science. It's not a matter of technique. It's not a matter of art. It is a science. It is a highly rational approach. But the mystery is only because this false ego really closes our understanding. It's a very beautiful example which is often given in the Shastra, which, these analogies are something amazing. How could any, it has to be Krishna or Krishna's devotees who can speak like this, one analogy and you get covered. Now you get a complete explanation. So false ego, the beautiful example is about the clouds. How when the cloud covers you say it's a cloudy day, in the monsoon, we just had the monsoons, and the days when we couldn't see the sun. But we say that we are not able to, it's been raining the whole day, the sun has not come out. But our ability to see that, the clouds, is also because of the source is the sun. The sun is behind the clouds, but the clouds are covering temporarily, but actually the source is the sun. So without the sun, we can't even see the clouds. But we don't realize that. So we say there's no sun, but actually the sun is always there. It is the source of the light, same in the moonlight. So the moon may be covered, but actually the clouds are only a temporary covering. So the false ego is like the cloud which covers our consciousness, but actually the soul is always permanent, it's always pure, it's uncontaminated, and because of the false ego we are perceiving it, and then the attachments of the body comes through. So because of the effort to understand where our false appreciation of ourself takes precedence over Krishna, that's why we say that the first statement generally starts by saying that I'm not this body. Everywhere the principle you see, if you go through journey of self-discovery or any of the lectures that we go through, especially in the initial stages, the basic instruction is always, Prabhupada would emphasize on that so often, that I am not this body, but that because it doesn't really, internally, we don't really realize that actually I am not this body, or if you understand it, we do it sometimes. So it has to go so deep into our psyche that I am not this body, I have to take care of it, I need to preserve it. I need to make it healthy. I need to do what is necessary. But it limits. But if we get too focused on that, that what is best for me, body, mind, soul, if we understand that the soul is most important, and we miss looking after the soul and only look after the body, then that is wrong. That's the main principle. So another way to look at this false ego is that we are told that the elements that make up this material, this matter, you know, there are 5 gross elements and 3 subtle elements. So earth, water, fire, air, ether, and then mind, intelligence, and false ego. The 5 are gross and 3 subtle elements. But actually, from earth to ego, the progression is from gross to less gross to less gross to less gross. So earth is the grossest, then water, then fire, then air, then ether. Ether is the most least gross, most subtle among the material elements, among the gross elements. And then mind is even more subtle because we can't see the mind. We can perceive it. Intelligence is even more subtle. And false ego is even more subtle. So the message that comes to us is that the subtlest of the element being false ego, we cannot perceive it through our intelligence. So it is, we may think that I'll try to understand, we cannot. So we can only perceive the symptoms. So just like in the body you have a tumor or some disease, you know, then you understand that what is happening. Similarly here, the perception or the understanding of the false ego would be through our attitude, to our behavior, symptoms of that the false ego is present. So if we understand that we have to, then we will be looking and judging our behavior, or we'll be closely trying to improve how we behave, how we talk, what we should do, why is it important. So it's a very practical necessity. The only thing is that if we still think that I will do it, but I must be the happiest person, and my happiness is defined by the way I think it is. That, okay, today I go to this 9 to 12 movie and I'm happy, that's my happiness. If something stops me from going, I'm unhappy. Then it's really unnecessary stress and a wrong notion that we cover. Or to say that I must have this, if I don't have it, I'm not happy. Or I must have that. It may be desirable that you can say, even for spiritual life, you may feel that I would like to do this so I couldn't, it would be nice if I have it. But there's a difference between desiring and working towards it, even if it's a good thing, and accepting the setback. Because so many things don't happen. Probably more things that we desire don't happen than what we desire and happen for us. So this attitude of being able to accept really comes from a continuous, sustained following of Krishna consciousness. That means consciousness that Krishna is in control of everything, and then we gradually move towards seeing Him everywhere. Now we may, like Srila Prabhupada's example again, like He's everything that He saw. If you see His videos, or if you hear about Him, it's amazing, you know. And when devotees speak about Him, that the smallest thing would remind Him of Krishna. He would just move, he's walking on the road and there's some water trickling there, and you know, he's walking on the Juhu beach, and then he'll go across and he'll close the tap, or he asks a devotee to do it, because he said this is Krishna's energy, he should not waste water. Everything he saw it in conjunction with Krishna. Suddenly he's walking under a tree, and then he's tapping the Tamal Krishna Maharaj, His Holiness Tamal Krishna Maharaj, one of the senior most disciples of Prabhupada. He recounts that, you know, when he was walking with Prabhupada in one of those morning walks, famous morning walks, and then Prabhupada would walk with his cane. Suddenly he stopped and then he was tapping his stick. What is this? So there was a tree and then there were some bird droppings. So now devotees were wondering what to say. So they were trying to think something spiritual. You know, how to explain, no? What to see into it. So they all gave different answers. And Prabhupada said, it's a bird dropping. But he said, what does it tell, you know? So then again there were farmers. Then Prabhupada was saying that, see, this just means that the bird is now come back to the tree. It has now migrated from one place to another. So same way our body also migrates from one body, soul migrates from one body to another. Immediately, you see, the smallest thing he would give an example. He would explain to them that how to look at it, that this is fresh. So that means the bird has come here, it has migrated from some other place. So everything that he saw, that is where the Acharya leads, by example, by his thought, by his word, and then he's put it into his books. So, if to the extent that we are able to follow that consistently, not just on a Sunday afternoon, but it could be a Monday morning, it could be a bad day in the week, it could be, you know, we go back and we have serious problems of various types. Through that, if we try to follow this and link it to our life, not only is it very reassuring, and but it is also very, you can say, it is very purifying for us, because then we make advancement. I remember His Grace Muralidhar Prabhu once was mentioning in a class that here, you know, many years ago, that I think the DT Kitchen was here. Maybe 20 years ago. And so Mataji's were making batata vadas. So His Holiness Radhanath Maharaj just popped into the... he just came in and he came to see what was happening. So then they were making, so he said, "What is this?" So somebody was explaining that, "Maharaj, this is a, you know," he said, "How do you do it?" So he's saying, "Maharaj, we have to first," he took the potato, saying, "We first wash it, then we peel it, then we cut it, and then we fry, deep fry it, you know." So that's a process. So immediately Radhanath Maharaj said that this is a devotee's life, you know. We also get washed, we get cut, we get purified, we get chopped, whatever, you know. So that is, all kinds of things are happening. So this is, so that, therefore, but through that, you know, if it is a better offering to someone, so if we have to, if Krishna wants us to be, you know, if we are to be a worthy of offering to Krishna, then He is going to put us through many tests. So if we believe in that process, then we have to accept it. And we are not the only one. It's not that I am the only sufferer. So many times, believe me, so many times. And you have to, if you really, sometimes when we get less absorbed in ourselves, and it happens that it's natural that when we are going through some calamity or problem, we're totally thinking about that, and sometimes feeling that, you know, my situation is the worst. But really, if we look to others, I'm always amazed to see how many, you know, somehow or the other you come to know the many, and you know a little bit about devotees' families, and you say, "My God, I mean, people have inconceivable problems." And so I wouldn't be able to accept that, but they're able to do it. So the minute we stop thinking about our own problem, the problem will be there, but we get the confidence and we get the strength to face it when we see how others are facing it. So, therefore, what Radhanath Maharaj was saying is that this is a routine process, nothing big. If the potato goes through the whole process, but then comes out as a batata vada, which is really tasty. So, same way, we will also be, if we allow ourselves to be going through the whole process, we'll also have to, we will also be worthy of being offered. So, if you look at Queen Kunti's prayers, you know, Queen Kunti's prayers are so important. And Queen Kunti, as we know, was the mother of the Pandavas. That Srila Prabhupada actually, while he was translating the Bhagavatam, and while he's written so many books, but he especially, this comes in the first canto, but he took out a series of lectures, which is made into a book, which are entirely on Queen Kunti's prayers. But why it is so pertinent? Because Queen Kunti was the mother of the king of the universe, because eventually Yudhishthira Maharaj became the king, and he was the king of the whole planet. And at that time, when he was the king of the planet, of the whole world, she speaks these very beautiful prayers. And while she went through more suffering than any of us could even imagine, and her story is known to all of us, but she never felt so, she never felt lonely, she never felt upset, she was with, but now when she's having success of the highest level, the war is over, her sons are victorious, they are among the very few who are surviving, and her oldest son is now is the king, a crowned king in front of all the kings of the world. Can you imagine what the situation is in the galaxy of all the kings are there, and Yudhishthira Maharaj is anointed the king. And in Krishna's presence. After that, Krishna is going back to Dwarka. And that's when she gives her lamentation, and she feels her heartfelt, very beautiful prayers. So, one particular prayer where she talks that, you know, when she's mentioning that, you know, high birth, beauty, wealth and intelligence or knowledge are actually could be impediments to our further growth and for a spiritual development, which is what we have been generally discussing. And when she says you have to be tvam akinchana gocharam, that means only those who are completely bereft of everything. Bereft of everything doesn't mean material possessions, but when the person feels that nothing is mine, you come to that stage, that person is the is fit for becoming a sincere devotee. So it is endorsed also by none other than a very great elevated pure devotee, Queen Kunti, saying that I'm feeling a loss when Krishna is going away, because when you are there, so I think she also says, let the calamities happen again and again. So because when the calamities happen, then I think of you. So please, let the calamities happen so that I keep thinking about you. Because otherwise we become spoiled when we are accustomed to all the things going our way. So Krishna, out of his kindness, so we have to have that faith that what he's doing for us is for us. So it is also said that in our practical life, you know, when we are raising children, that we sometimes are maybe spoiling them. So actually, it is the greatest disservice we can do for our children that we, give them what they want all the time. Otherwise, they'll be spoiled. Like we see in the example of Duryodhan. Duryodhan was, his father gave him everything. And then eventually, he just could not accept even the slightest reversal. Even after seeing Krishna in his universal form in front of him, still he wouldn't accept. So that could be our position on a very small level, but that eventually that we may find that I want because I've been getting everything that I need. But we also have examples of great personalities who have temporarily been affected and then bounced back because they had the humility to accept their weakness. Like Indra, for instance, in his story, because he got so upset and angry, and recently we celebrated Govardhan Puja. So he tried his best because he temporarily forgot that Krishna is in control. And then Krishna, out of his deep love for Indra, he corrected him by depriving him of his sense gratification and really affecting Indra's plans. But Indra then eventually, when he saw that, so it was, you can imagine the humiliation he must have felt, that he is the king of heavens. He's the leading devta, one of the leading devtas among the 33 million devtas who are controlling all the whole universe. And in that, he's now exposed in front of everyone. But still, he does come, and that too through a very close devotee of the Lord, Surbhi Kao, who comes and pleads on his behalf. And then he accepts it. So the difference between a devotee and a demoniac mentality would be that eventually we may make mistakes, but we would be accepting it, and through that humiliation we see the purification. So Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur also mentions that these high birth and learning and all, which are could be very useful for our, if we put it the right way, just like we have in our temple and in many organizations, spiritual organizations, including ISKCON, we have many people who are academically very gifted. So many have come from IITs and doctors and engineers. And some are, they may not have academically qualified, but they're highly intelligent. Because Prabhupada said only an intelligent person takes to Krishna consciousness. The real intelligence is to understand that we are not this body. So academically there could be differences of backgrounds, but nevertheless we don't get carried away with it. So Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur says that actually if we, it is a very tricky line. So it is all these attributes that we get of good looks or high birth, social status that is, or wealth. It could be like, he gives the example that it's like a person is drowning in the sea and then he has a heavy gold crown on his head. So the gold crown is very attractive. If somebody offers a gold crown, you take it. But if it is put on the person's head, or somebody is drowning, it will make him drown even faster. So the attributes by themselves are not wrong. But if it is with the consciousness that I need, that it is for me, rather than being grateful that Krishna has given me and I must discover what, how I can put it to best use. That's the key, that's the difference. And again, we have several examples of Rupa Goswami and Sanatana Goswami who were not only millionaires, but they were prime minister and home minister, chief minister and home minister of a state. Imagine, and then they abandoned everything to come to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and completely surrendered, and they are one of the two of the six Goswamis. And then you have King Pratap Rudra on the other side, who was the king of Odisha, which was much larger than what we see now. And he was a very, very great king. But when he was told that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would not see him because he is a king, and he said, then if that is the case, I'll give up everything. So instantly he decided that he will give up his kingdom and everything, because for him, most important is to try to serve the Lord. Of course, the Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was very happy with this attitude, but he took this, he was willing to do it. It was not a pretense, he was actually willing to do it. So we can see from these examples, and there are many like this, where to develop these as our heroes and our goals is what we should be looking for. So as another very nice example I had heard is one of our brahmacharis, Nityanand Prabhu, once in his class he was mentioning, because his background, his family, he is very learned also in the Sri Sampradaya. He has a lot of knowledge. So he was giving this example about Lord Ram. As we know that Lord Ram had, there were four brothers, Ram, Bharat, Lakshman and Shatrughna. So Lord Ram means the all-attractive one. Bharat means the one who is carrying the load, burden. Lakshman is the wealthiest, but wealthiest of service, means who has a lot of wealth of service. And Shatrughna means who kills the enemy. So he was quoting, he said the acharyas are saying, they say that actually they considered Bharat to be even greater than Lakshman, because Bharat voluntarily gave up the, he understood the internal mood and the mission of the Lord, and he gave up the association of the Lord, and he accepted the service of running the country for 14 years, but on behalf of the Lord. But he talked about Shatrughna, and he said that Shatrughna, who's the least spoken, we normally talk of the other three much more. The Shatrughna, his name says that he is one who kills demons. He only killed one demon, it was Lavanasur. But actually speaking, what is meant is that he killed the one internal enemy. And that internal enemy is that the killer, he resisted the temptation of being attracted to the all-powerful attraction of Lord Ram, his personality, his features, his character. And he voluntarily accepted the service of Bharat. So he became the servant of the servant of the servant. He became the servant of the servant. And this is what pleases the Lord the most. So the acharyas actually say, he was quoting, that Shatrughna is considered greater than Bharat and Lakshman, because he was very silently accepting the service of his brother, who was doing wonderful service of Lord Ram. So from that we can see that we don't need to, and he was actually living the principle of what Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur said, that you should serve in such a way that the Lord wants to see you, rather than we want to say, I want to see the Lord. But actually we do in such a way that we can, we attract his attention, just because we are serving, we are only focused on the service selflessly. Another very nice example is about this young maid servant who was in Shivas Thakur's house. Her name was Dukhi. And Shivas Thakur was one of the five Panchatattvas, was also eternal associate of the Lord. And actually, he's actually the representative as a devotee. But he, Dukhi was one maid servant who was, she was just one of the many maid servants who was helping in the, carrying the pots of water. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu noticed that when the kirtans were going, and in Shivas Thakur's house, it was very famous because they had the most wonderful kirtans which went on right through the night. And people would be desperate to even hear that, come and participate. They were not allowed to, but they would like to hear about it. So here she was someone who was inside the house because she was serving. But she was not even looking at the kirtans or not looking at Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, but only focused on a service of carrying the pots from the Ganges and bringing it to the, and lining it for the help, benefit of the devotees, because the devotees used to have so much kirtan, they would perspire a lot. So, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu asked about her and then came to know that her name is Dukhi. So he said, he pronounced that from now on she should be known as Sukhi. And completely from that moment on, she became, eventually went back to Godhead and was part of Lord Chaitanya's Leela. So we can see that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is giving us this view that his acceptance of the services of people, of whoever, is not based on any caste, creed or background, wealth, looks, intelligence, social status, nothing. It is really based on, so it is open for all, anyone. But it is based on our consciousness and our mood to serve. So we can take that as a very reassuring that, you know, there's no requirement basically. It just requires that we believe in that and we accept it. I think I should end now. So I just like to end by, and one other example I'll just mention, which His Holiness Radhanath Maharaj was quoting some time ago, that this famous bhajan singer Anup Jalota, you know, he once told Maharaj that when he, after a program, so he of course has also done programs for ISKCON, as he's been doing outside for commercial purposes. And he said, it was a confession, he said that I don't really feel any satisfaction, I don't get much satisfaction when I am performing, even when there are thousands of people in the audience, when they it's a purely a commercial program. People come there, they pay for the tickets and I'm giving the programs. As much as I feel when I'm performing, where I don't get any money, but I'm coming and performing for ISKCON or helping them. So he, not being a kind of devotee in the sense of coming regularly to the temple and all, but even he could sense that how much the sweetness of devotional service is when we are doing it selflessly for the helping others without any motivation. So this ahaituki pratihatha, which is the definition of approach that we should take for devotional service, that unmotivated and uninterrupted means it should be continuous and it should have no motivation. This is that it could be even for those who tasted temporarily, and he was astonished at how I feel so much pleasure here. And I don't get that much pleasure when I'm performing, though there are thousands of people, and I do it. It is, but compared to that, here there may be lesser number of people, but because somehow I'm doing it for the Lord in a small way, I feel much more pleasurable. So we'll end here. And are there any questions? We can have maybe a few minutes. Is there anything? Okay. So you have to pass the mic. We'll take one or two if there are a few minutes.
हरे कृष्णा प्रभु जी हिंदी में बताऊं जरा प्रभु जी थोड़ा विस्तार से कहता हूं क्योंकि नहीं तो सुनने वालों के मन में संदेह हो सकता है कि मैं भगवान के प्रति दोष दृष्टि रखता हूं ऐसा नहीं है एक्चुअली बात यह है कि भक्तों से मुझे यह पता चला है कि कुरुक्षेत्र की रणभूमि में श्री कृष्ण जी ने अर्जुन को 45 मिनट्स में भगवद गीता सुनाई थी तो ऐसे भी लोग हैं जो भगवान के प्रति दोष दृष्टि रखते हैं किसी ने यह कहा था कि लड़ाई के मैदान में 45 मिनट्स तक दो लोगों की बात होना कुछ विश्वास करने योग्य नहीं जान पड़ता खैर उसकी बात से वैसे भी हमें कोई मतलब नहीं है क्योंकि हमारी तो भगवान के प्रति पूर्ण श्रद्धा है मैं तो आपसे ये विनती करता हूं कि कृपया मेरे इस प्रश्न का उत्तर दें कि जिस समय प्रभु अर्जुन को गीता सुना रहे थे उस समय में रणभूमि में और भी बहुत से लोग थे वो क्या कर रहे थे
मैं तभी था तो नहीं और शायद होगा मालूम नहीं वो भी मालूम नहीं शायद कौरव में होगा पांडव में वो भी मालूम नहीं लेकिन मैं आई कैन एक्सप्लेन के कृष्णा की जो एक्टिविटीज है दे आर एक्सट्रीमली यू कैन से देयर 65 million people on that battle. Was it crores or millions? 65 crores, can you imagine, which is really about America and Russia's population together today, all on one battlefield. So if you see Kurukshetra now, we cannot imagine how can 65 crore people fit here. So there are many things about Krishna. I'm answering in English, but I think you probably must be understanding since you are also in the audience. So we cannot understand about how he spoke in 90 minutes, the whole Bhagavad Gita, is also something which is something which is of the consciousness which is beyond us. Because Arjun just heard once the whole Bhagavad Gita and he understood and he had everything in his heart. We need to read it hundreds of times and we still don't get it. So we're talking of a level of a time which was a very different era and a different type of consciousness which was highly elevated. Imagine Krishna starts only by telling the difference between the body and the soul. So we need so much of understanding first to understand that we are not this body. He didn't have to tell Arjun that you are not this body. It would have been an insult to his intelligence because the elevation of consciousness was such. So in the same way, when they were talking, what the others were doing, I mean, they must be also very much waiting patiently because they were also probably well trained and disciplined to know that they would only follow. Like when they ended the war, when the sun set, they started when the sun rose, they had the principles. So there were certain principles. So I guess they must have waited. And out of courtesy, they let Krishna finish the Bhagavad Gita. Only one more question we'll take. So just one question.
Hare Krishna Prabhu. My question is that how can we balance between spirituality and wealth and fame? Because when we become wealthy or famous, we associate with the people who are not devotees, basically. So it kind of affects us, right? So how do we balance it?
So it's a challenge. It's a very big challenge. So therefore, we need help. And if we... So the main basis on what I was trying to say also was that whatever we do, we need to associate with devotees and with scriptures and activities like coming to temple and not just coming for a sightseeing visit, spiritual tourism. Not that we come and appreciate the clothes or the deities or the painting and go away. Not that. But we actually come and try to understand related to our problems. So when we start associating that way and really imbibe the principles, and then we actually see that we are succumbing to those problems. So we then, again, either we hear or we in private we talk to individuals and get help. So the fact is that first that when we ourselves worry about it, it's a good sign. Others, most people would think that there's nothing, so what? That is what is needed. You know, wealth is meant to enjoy for myself. That's the main principle. So if somebody questions and says that, I'm worried because I'm not able to control my senses or I'm not able to control my activities for myself and not all the time. So it's a very good sign. And if we have a consistent, regular association and follow a certain practice of bhakti, like we're chanting regularly, every day, regularly. See, we can't do a stop-start when we get suddenly inspired and then we may let go for some time. It has to be continuous. So if you do that, definitely Krishna will help us. Okay. So we stop here. So all glories to Prabhupada.